1.5 million subscribers after 13 years on YouTube. We finally made it to this massive milestone. And to celebrate, I'm doing a Q&A. You've sent in a ton of questions and I'm keen to dive in and answer your questions. Smilin underscore Swami asks, what mindset do you maintain to surpass failures and stay on the path? Failure is inevitable, guys. It's going to happen if you're trying to do things. And I find that your approach to failure is more important than failure itself. If you look at it as a deficit in your character, you're flawed, you're bad for making a mistake and for failing, that's not a really good way to approach failure at large. A more healthy way is to look at it as a learning experience. And this sounds great conceptually and principally. During the moment, it sucks, but if you can identify failure as something that you can extract from, get the information you need, internalize it, and then take the necessary steps to succeed, then that's a good way to do it. If you can minimize the gap between feeling salty and taking action, that is growth, and that is going to help you with managing failure. The interesting thing about failure is that it's on you to take responsibility, because rarely will someone outline everything for you about why something went wrong. More often than not, people are going to be indifferent when you screw up, or they'll forget about it because they're so concerned with themselves. You have to take responsibility for failure when it happens and do the homework necessary on how you failed to make sure that you come out the other side and actually get lessons from it. The interesting thing about failure is that it teaches you so much more than success. I mean, we all want success. That is the end goal. Reaching something that we put our mind to and achieving it feels awesome, but you don't really learn well from success. So if you can see failure as something to help you level up, to progress in whatever you're doing, then it's a really good way to look at it and have a healthy relationship with failure. Chris in Motion asks, what is the legacy you want to leave with fitness FAQs? Awesome question. This is the type of stuff where you think about what gets you up in the morning, what adds meaning to your life, what is your vocation, what is your purpose. And for me, it's to educate and empower people to master calisthenics. I want us all to become strong like a gymnast, look like a bodybuilder, and have the flexibility to move freely. I'm someone who wants to practice what they preach so that I can be a positive role model to uplift others to raise their standards. I want to leave a body of work which adds knowledge to the fitness community. I want to discuss evergreen principles which can be followed forever to get physically and mentally strong. I want to add value to eliminate the confusion, increase the clarity, and give people confidence on their fitness journey. Jasperif asks, what's your opinion on creatine use in calisthenics? So creatine is made in the kidney, liver, and pancreas from amino acids. It's useful for strength and power output thanks to its use for ATP production. Do I take it? No. Do I recommend creatine for calisthenics athletes? No. The reason for this is the potential benefits outweigh the downsides of increased body weight through water retention. So with body weight training, we are all about relative strength, trying to maximize how good we are at moving our body through space. So everything equal, we would rather be lighter, leaner, and have less body weight to make our life easier. Now, if you're someone who's in an absolute strength sport, like powerlifting, weightlifting, and you're not as concerned with weight classes, creatine is much more useful. If you do decide to take creatine, 5 to 10 grams per day is a good approach. It's one of the most researched supplements that you can take, creatine monohydrate. Just make sure you take sufficient water and you're not going to get the side effects of nausea and stuff like that. Also for me, there's no need to take creatine because I have plenty of red meat and fish in my nutrition already. I've never been deficient in creatine on any blood work that I've done. That's during training periods and also when I'm not training. So we can't conflate muscle damage with that increased creatine. So at large, if the nutrition's on check, your creatine's gonna be fine. If by blood work you are deficient, supplementing may be useful to bring you up to a normal level, but otherwise, a calisthenics athlete, no real major benefit as the benefits are offset by the weight gain. Tan.strength asks, how often do you get recognized in public? I want to share a funny story about this actually. I was on a second date and I was just leaving an activity that we were doing, we're walking out, it was going great. And I got approached by someone on the street and it was an awesome dude, very positive guy. And he had really nice things to say about me. He basically said, oh, Daniel, I've been following you for so long. You're a legend, man. You helped me so much with calisthenics. And the guy was basically selling me to the person that I was with. He's like, oh yeah, he's a really great guy. He's awesome. He's really friendly and he's a cool dude. And I'm there with the person I'm on a date with. And it was hilarious because you couldn't have planned something like that in terms of if you're trying to present yourself in the best way. And I found it hilarious. I think I made a little joke like, oh yeah, dude, I'll just give you the money afterwards type of thing. And I thought, oh, that was a pretty good situation. So it's happening more in public in the last 2 years, particularly so in gyms and parks. It's awesome. I always have time to chat. If you do see me in person, come say hi. I'd love to hear about your fitness journey and talk shop a little bit. It's just awesome. Without you guys, like I said, this fitness FAQ stuff wouldn't exist. So don't feel shy. When I first started getting recognized, I was a bit funny with it because, you know, this is the whole online thing. And sometimes I'd see people looking at me and I'd think, oh, do I have like some food on my face? Or did I like not, you know, brush my hair or something this morning? For those type of people that maybe recognize me, but maybe that's just them just, you know, admiring the gains, boys. Dexus Alonso asks, is diet more important than workout? I think we can agree that both are important, and without one, you're shortchanging your results. Nutrition's important for providing the energy and glycogen to fuel high-intensity workouts. Nutrition's important for overall energy levels, so that you can bring enthusiasm and your full mental faculties to work, study, relationships. But when it comes to the training side of things, this is what matters to get the strength and muscularity that you're looking for. Without this stress stimulus, you're not going to be able to make changes to your body. With that being said, nutrition offers the building blocks to provide protein, carbohydrates, fat, to replenish what is depleted, spark that repair process so that you can regenerate, repair, and grow stronger, bigger for your subsequent workouts. I feel that both, when they're in harmony, is a match made in heaven. If you've optimized your nutrition and your training, you're well on your way to getting what you want out of your journey. With that being said, I feel that nutrition is super important when it comes to longevity, health as you age, all of these things. If your nutrition is garbage, you're putting bad things in your body. Over time, I can't imagine that being a net positive for you. That's my bro science succinctly summarizing the research on longevity. Michelle Y asks, what is your least favorite exercise that you still incorporate into your routine and why? For me, it is the back extension. As we know with calisthenics, we're very upper back dominant with our pushing and pulling. The lower back, spinal erectors, posterior chain, the lower portion gets heavily neglected. So for me, I've got a real love-hate relationship with the 45 degree back extension. Through the very nature of this exercise, moderate to high reps are best for overloading this very fatigue resistant area of the body. But every time afterwards, without fail, because I'm pushing myself, I get dizzy, I feel quite faint and disorientated after a set. I've been so close to passing out many times. That's one downside. The second downside is the lower back pump is quite tremendous and it is really, really uncomfortable to walk around with a very pumped lower back. And the sensation is very unfamiliar from what I'm used to, but I know it is doing my body good. With back extensions as well, it's pretty awkward to set up. So you've either got a bar behind the head or you're holding dumbbells here, or you've got a Zercher position. So the setup's a bit tricky as well. This is me getting a little bit complaining here. And also, because we're doing such high time under tension, so many reps, you really have to concentrate on your form, because the difference between just swinging up or getting that nice contraction, going all the way down, pausing, makes a night and day difference to the results that you get. So it just really requires your full attention and focus, but it giveth a lot as well. But the stimulus to fatigue is great. You can get the job done without going super heavy. You can really target the muscles that are weak and deficient for the calisthenics-based person. And it's a good replacement for just doing more deadlifts or good morning variations that can be globally taxing when done at a higher frequency. So I still keep in those back extensions in my routine, even though I despise them. Nomadic.strength. Not trying to be a dick, but why haven't we seen many PRs from you in such a long time? My goals have shifted since 2018. I've transitioned from being an athlete to being a teacher. I feel that it would be doing everyone a disservice and would be selfish if I was to just focus on PRs. Trying to get my message across by only setting personal records is a really inefficient and ineffective way to do what I'm trying to accomplish with fitness FAQs. I'm trying to teach you guys principles and concepts. Do I really need to have world record strength to accomplish that? No. If I can do 3 one-arm pull-ups versus doing 10, is that a big difference? Do I really need to be 3% body fat to get this message across? Is an extra 20 kilos on my dip worth the squeeze? I don't feel that setting PRs is a requirement for me to connect authentically with my audience. Full respect to people that are world-class, competing and pushing the envelope. I know what it takes to get there, and I commend you for that dedication. I'm just running a different race. I feel with my knowledge as a physiotherapist and skin in the game with experience in calisthenics, I have more words of wisdom to offer than PRs alone. ASAP.69, what is your average training schedule like? Thank you for everything you've done for the calisthenics community. Appreciate the question and thank you for the support. I do 5 workouts a week, each lasting around 1.5 hours. I follow a push, legs, pull, rest, push, pull, rest split. This is sustainable for me. It suits my lifestyle. It meets my objectives that I have with training, being predominantly upper body focused. It's fun. I can follow it in the best and the worst of times. When I'm busy or when I have more time, it's something that I can commit to. And I feel that that is the overarching principle of what constitutes a successful routine to follow. So for me, on these 5 days, I start with my calisthenics, my weighted calisthenics, my skill work, anything requiring balance, complexity, and technique, those compound movements like dips, handstand push-ups, all that good stuff I put at the start of my workout. Then at the end of my workout, I finish with either bodyweight basics, bodyweight isolation, or machines, weights, etc., to really get that hypertrophic stimulus at the end, that real hybrid style of training that I've been working on recently and really enjoying. So nothing crazy with my routine, 5 days a week, just brutal consistency over the years for 14 years, and that'll make anyone progress, I'm sure. Ski asks, do you still work as a physio, physiotherapist, or physical therapist? What is your work schedule? So I worked as a physio for 2 years. So from 2015 to 2017, I did 1 year full-time, 1 year part-time, and I no longer work as a clinical physiotherapist. I've been full-time on fitness FAQs since 2018. My current work schedule, Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. I really try and focus my work time to that period so that I don't let it bleed into my social life, my relationships, etc. Having that schedule allows me to stay in this for the long term, especially as a business owner. You can always find stuff to do. You can always be working. But what's been healthy for me is having really set times to work hard, and then move on to the other stuff that I value in life. Terrell Briggs asks, what's your favorite YouTube video that you've made on the channel? Without a doubt, the 10-year calisthenics transformation is my all-time favorite. It discusses my fitness values, the journey. I get raw and vulnerable in that one. And you get to see a side of me that maybe you don't get to see in the normal fitness tutorials. And I feel that it's a really uplifting message for young men to hear, especially if they're striving to achieve things in this world, to develop their character, have a mission, and just the process of doing that. And this is really going to give you some insight into how I think and how I believe is a healthy way to operate in this world. Jordan B, what are your top three favorite bodyweight exercises? Pull-up, handstand push-up, and the dip. The pull-up is the goat of vertical pulling. You can work on weighted calisthenics with this to afford you a lifetime of progression potential. You can move on to the one-arm pull, the one-arm chin, which keeps pretty much everyone challenged for a really long period of time. With that exercise, you've got so many variations with the different grips you can use. Do you go unilateral? Do you add load to the exercise? Do you go high rep? Do you go low rep? Absolutely love it, and it is an exercise that I keep doing for the rest of my life. Handstand push-ups, you've got strength and skill combined into the exercise. You've also got the handstand in the mix there. This is a movement that is just so fun to do because you're controlling your body in space. Vertical pressing gives you so much in terms of muscular development as well. You have the challenge of the balance and the technique component. You can do handstand push-ups with a wall, without a wall. There's a lot of potential for more advanced pressing through increased range of motion, 90-degree push-ups. You can do elevated handstand push-ups. The sky's the limit. I don't think anyone's going to outgrow handstand push-ups anytime soon. Lastly, cannot go wrong with the dip. This is the squat of the upper body. With the ability to add load to this exercise, it is so much fun. Going that raw strength, you got those big dip belt there with the weight plate swinging around. You're feeling like a damn gorilla. Rings, pause reps. We could talk on and on about the dip, but I feel it's a highly underrated exercise in gym culture at large. I feel if people knew how to do it correctly, how to progress with it, they would see that it offers so much and it is a really enjoyable exercise. Christian B says, what made you start training seriously when you were a young kid? So my introduction into physical training was through parkour. So I started doing this as a young kid, move your body, explore. And through this, I also was introduced to conditioning. So doing things like push-ups, pull-ups, dips, different bodyweight circuits in order to make sure that you had the requisite strength to be able to do climb-ups, muscle-ups, these type of things that were applied for parkour. So eventually I got to a point with parkour where I was going into more and more precarious and dangerous things at heights, and the risk to reward wasn't really there. And I found myself enjoying a lot more of the calisthenics and bodyweight stuff. So I started to pivot into that world a bit more. That's when I was on the internet and I discovered through YouTube different people doing calisthenics in America, most notably the Barbarians. So seeing these guys with amazing physiques, getting ripped, strong, using only their body weight at a park was extremely inspiring as a young kid. So I started to explore that, and going through the forums that the Barbarians had helped me to be surrounded by like-minded people. Thanks to the internet, thanks to these positive role models, I was hooked. And then it opened up a whole other gateway of training. So then I started doing my handstands in 2009, self-taught. It was just a really enjoyable way to use my pastime, because as someone that was growing up, was quite a shy, introverted kid, didn't have too many friends, had a lot of spare time. I started to channel that into training. So through calisthenics, I started to slowly develop my body and improve and see that improvement. It was a real positive feedback loop, because you're seeing the physical changes in your body. You're seeing the ability to set a goal, stick to it, and achieve it. And just the sense of fulfillment which comes from knowing that you can do something which you thought was previously out of your reach. So then, you know, I'd have people asking me, Daniel, how do you train? And then I started to dabble in personal training, doing online coaching. And this forced me to expand my knowledge, get clearer on my teaching so that I could continue to evolve both individually and also get the best results for my students. Ricardo 27, when did you start incorporating weightlifting to your regime? I've been doing upper body strictly calisthenics plus weighted calisthenics for 12 years. I started doing weightlifting for the legs in 2012. I've been incorporating hybrid training, so combining calisthenics, weighted calisthenics, with gym exercises, including dumbbells, machines, barbells, since 2022, very seriously. And I honestly believe that this combination affords you the best of both worlds, has a lot of longevity in terms of progression potential, and it's just fun. It's just, you have so many variations of exercise to do. And I really feel that this is the future of fitness, and that's what I'm pushing with Fitness FAQs, this really holistic approach to training where we're doing bodyweight exercises, we're lifting weights, and it really allows you to plug the missing pieces from both disciplines. So highly recommend weight training to make you a really complete individual, well-balanced, and you'll really enjoy the journey. Maureen K, do you train as a gymnast before launching into Fitness FAQs? I'm sure this is a question most people doing calisthenics have been asked at least once in their training career. And the answer for me is no. I did not do gymnastics as a child. I came into this as a teenager through seeing it online and then pursuing it myself. So no background with formal teaching in gymnastics or bodyweight exercise. With that said, I did have a little bit of a sporting background. I mean, I played table tennis when I was a teenager, I played a bit of basketball, I played some Aussie rules football, but I transitioned into doing calisthenics and handstands as a teenager, 17, and then just pursued it from there. So it's a common misconception that anyone that is good at bodyweight training has a background in gymnastics. No, you don't have to have had a background in that, it would help, but plenty of people are achieving great things learning later in life as adults. So don't lose faith. Don't try and look for reasons why you can't do this stuff. Look for reasons why you can. Calisthenics is accessible and you don't have to be a gymnast to try. Tipri asks, what things have you changed your opinion on the most? Anything from disagreements with other YouTubers to your own advice that you've reevaluated? I'll keep it off the YouTube drama and onto myself personally. I've stopped majoring in the minor details. I used to get so obsessed with complicating absolutely everything, planning things out to a T 10, 12 weeks in advance. I had to do these sets, these reps, this exercise, and it was all overly methodical to a fault where it wasn't producing the return on investment required to do all that stuff, both from planning and also on my mental toll. These days I've got a structure, I've got a workout plan, but I auto-regulate sets, reps, intensity based on where I am in the training phase, based on my signs and symptoms that I'm presenting with myself and on paper as well. But I'm not afraid to adjust things on the fly and use my best judgment. I'd also say that I focus way too much on weak link exercises, trying to find where in the kinetic chain I've got a deficit and focusing on that. Things like scap pulls, all these band rotator cuff drills, and don't get me wrong, they're helpful, just not to the extent that I was doing them. In my warm-ups, after my training, it was taking so much time and it was very fatiguing. Now I know the law of specificity reigns supreme. I've got a major goal, I do the exercise that facilitates and closely replicates that goal, and I minimize the superfluous exercises that I do. This way I have the time and energy to focus on what matters, which is progressing my plan, resting, recovering, and actually improving. GCM, What's a hobby you have that is completely different from calisthenics? This might surprise some of you. Reading. I started reading in 2019, and if you told me when I was younger, Daniel, you'd be really into reading, I would say you're a damn fool. But something that I've really cultivated an interest in, and it's an avid hobby of mine, is reading. I read around 25 books on average a year, and my interests are psychology, philosophy, and self-development. The top three books that I've got are Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, and The Body Keeps Score, Bessel van der Kolk. Those are great reads to get started if you have an interest in those categories that I've recommended. Reading before bed has become a ritual. So for 30 to 60 minutes before I go to sleep, I'm tucked in bed, I've got my Kindle, I'm learning things, I'm slowly getting tired, and it's a great habit that I've cultivated to keep learning but also switch off so I can go to sleep. Another way to get more pages read is to install the Kindle app on your phone, turn on text-to-speech, voila, you've got yourself a audiobook, and this allows you while you're commuting, while you're doing the chores, active doing things. You can learn, you can get those page counts up, and before you know it, you'll be reading books and gaining knowledge. The Amiyagi asks, do you put the toilet roll back on the holder with the paper on the outside or the inside? Firstly, this sounds like a dating app question, but I will answer it. Without a doubt, it is on the outside, all day, every day, 100%. If you put it on the inside, the toilet paper scrapes against the wall, it's harder to access, it's a no-go. With that being said, I am a scruncher when it comes to wiping. This might come as a shock to some of you, given my personality and conscientiousness, but just marinate on that one for a little bit. D_Navara, how do you continue to stay so consistent over the years? What's your mindset like? For me, health and fitness is one of my biggest values. So in that sense, I have created a lifestyle where I'm able to stick to this and make it an important aspect of my weekly routine. I have a habit set up where exercising at the same time of the day, first thing in the morning, makes it possible, just like brushing my teeth. It's a routine that I do without even having to put much effort into or thought in terms of the action required to get there. It's more difficult not to do it because it's such a part of my life that it would feel foreign not to have that as something that I consistently do. For me, consistency stems from both an intrinsic and extrinsic desire to do what I do. If no one was watching, I would still be training. I love this stuff, and that was highlighted during all those lockdown periods that we had where you didn't have the attention, you didn't have the feedback, you were there in isolation, and I realized that just the process of training is something that I love and enjoy just for the task itself. So the consistency at its root stems from me just loving the task, loving the journey, loving the process, the daily grind of doing the physical activity. And of course, we can't discount the extrinsic motivation. Getting the status, getting the feedback from all of you, doing this as an occupation, it really does fuel into this perfect storm of consistency. So if you can find that blend for you, I find that you won't really struggle with being consistent. Erothiorx15 asks, is it okay to slightly flare the elbows during handstand pushups? It depends on the goal. If you're someone who wants to get specific strength for advanced calisthenics, we're talking planche pushups, we're talking freestanding handstand pushups with the goal of 90 degree pushups, you're better off using a closer grip, tucked elbow pressing mechanics because we want to build specific strength for what we're trying to achieve and use comparable biomechanics to what we're working towards. If you're someone that purely wants to build muscle, you have no concern of achieving these strength skills and you just want to use handstand pushups to grow your chest, shoulders, triceps, by all means, have a slight flare. I think most experts agree that pressing in that scapular plane, roughly 30 degrees of elbow flare, is going to be safe on the shoulders and it's going to give you good overhead pressing strength, decent transferability across the board, and it's also safe. You need to consider your goal when you're making any decision like this, because it's not never do this, only do this. You can flare if you want to build muscle. You should tuck if you want to build strength. The context means everything. When it comes to professionals, friends, whoever telling you, you can only do it this way, always question that dogmatic thinking. And always couple that with what feels best for your body, what suits your goals. And I think you'll be in a great place if you just keep that in mind. With respect to that elbow flare, if you are going super flared like that and it's hurting your shoulders, chances are that's not really good for your body. Chances are if you need to compensate so much, the intensity is too high. So you need to scale it back to something like a pike push-up, something that you can actually tolerate that scapular plane or tucked elbow pressing. So pain and compensation is a manifestation of weakness or something that's not suiting your body. So always keep that in mind. Barbosa asks, how has your mindset regarding changed as you grow older? Now the game has changed. I have a responsibility to stay healthy, not only for my own personal practice, my own personal progression and goals, but for you. I'm doing this as a means to teach, educate, impact people. And I can't do that if I'm not healthy. So when I was younger, I was probably a bit more reckless with my training intensity and really striving to always, always improve. And now it's different, right? Like I just said, I can't be doing that if it comes at the expense of doing my ultimate purpose here, which is educating each and every one of you watching because I'm injured. I'm sure that you probably agree with that thinking. And it's a real mature way to think about what provides you the most fulfillment, what is the most sustainable for your body as well. And also just through growing up, you realize that, geez, it just doesn't matter that much to hit those amazing PRs. Moving on, I'd say that I would embrace simplicity over complexity. When I first started training, you're excited about learning all the latest science, and you see a different exercise you put in your program. You hear about a different principle of how to design a training program, you play with it. Because you're constantly learning, you're like a sponge. It's just too irresistible not to apply things all the time. And then before you know it, after some years of learning, you got all this information and you're experimenting with all these different things. It becomes really complex. You don't really know what you're doing, what is working. Was it this input? Was it this input? There's just so many variables that are changing all the time. You almost are worse off than the person that doesn't know as much. So for me, I embrace simplicity at large with my exercise selection, with my program design. I apply that to 80% of what I do. It's the big basics. It's nothing glamorous. It's nothing that you don't know. The 20% is relative to my body with what I'm working on, what I'm struggling with, weaknesses as such. But yeah, big on the basics these days. Third thing I'd say is just patience and consistency over intensity. When I was younger, it was all or nothing, as I just said before. Now it's a lot more calculated. It's a lot more methodical. It's a lot more removed from the emotions of wanting it now. I can see the bigger picture. I know things take time. I know that it's the accumulation of workout after workout, week after week, month after month. It's not one good session. It's what I've built over time. And just having that awareness that as you become intermediate and advanced, things take time. And it's very freeing not to be so stressed about individual sessions and know that all that work that I'm doing is paying off, both for my own training and also the impact I have on others. Lancelot-YK, do you consider yourself a push or pull guy? I'm definitely a pull guy, so I've got a short torso and long limbs. I find pull-ups easier than push-ups. I find deadlifts easier than squats. Now, with that being said, I'm going to enjoy pulling movements more because I'm better at them, and I'll probably put more effort into them, and that's just going to happen. On the flip side, I am not going to look at push movements as something that I'm not going to try on. I'm just going to have an understanding that based on my limb length, joint, muscle insertions, etc., it's going to be harder. You can look at this two ways. You can see it like you'll never be good at it, or you can accept the increased challenge as an asset. So because I find it harder, I'm going to get more stimulation from less reps, less intensity. Basically, it's going to be harder for me, everything else equal, so I'll get more gains from it. I'm going to put effort into what I'm good at, and what I'm not good at is the moral of the story. But knowing your limb length, pull or push preference goes a long way in understanding a situation and coming to peace with it. Trust Life asks, any advice on 40 plus getting into calisthenics? Firstly, good on you for getting into it, because unfortunately, muscle mass after you're 30 decreases at a rate of 3-5% per decade. So focusing on that high protein diet and resistance training with calisthenics is a good start. As you get older, taking your warm-up seriously is really important. This affords you the range of motion necessary to get into the positions, but also ensure that you're warmed up and prime to give your best effort in the workout. Instability is something that older people tend to have an issue with. So by slowing down the exercise, pausing, all of this stuff is going to increase stability. And just working within your means at an exercise intensity will ensure that you develop stability over time. Variety is key too. Don't just do the same thing over and over again, because that's going to beat up your joints, tendons, and increase your susceptibility to injury. By rotating exercises, doing different grips on pull-ups, changing your row variations, these are all good examples of variety and how that's going to keep you in the game long term. Moderate rep ranges are your friend. 8-15 repetitions, 10-20 second isometric holds. This intensity is going to be physically and psychologically sustainable to keep you training long term. Don't think of being an aging athlete as something all bad. As you get older, maturity is on your side. You're more likely to listen to your body, be in tune of the signals that it's sending, and respond accordingly. Younger people tend to be more reckless with what they're doing, so there is something going for you in your favor as a 40 plus athlete. Being realistic with expectations is important. You're not going to be progressing with as much strength and muscle size as someone in their 20s. Once you understand this, you can have a healthy perspective on your journey, but you can also temper that with the enthusiasm to try and fight for that improvement. So don't sell yourself short, but also be aware that you're not going to make the gains like the younger people. Lastly, accept that training goals change as we age. Into the later decades, we're talking 60s plus, sarcopenia is really going to start to set in. It's going to be harder and harder to work out. And inevitably, your goals will shift from improvement to maintenance to slowing the rate of decline. That is a worthy goal as you get older, because the more muscle and the more strength that you can hold on to, and you're slowing that decline, you'll have better longevity and you'll be a more healthy individual. So just keep that in mind. We're all heading that way. Andreas.zh, how do you stay shredded year round? Firstly, I appreciate the compliment, but I would say that I am lean and not shredded. The difference between that is in terms of the body fat percentage. I'd hover around 10 to 12% year round, and this is based on performance and also the aesthetic that I'm going for. I want to maximize my relative strength, but I also want to present my muscularity by not having too much fat around my muscles so that I can convey my message through fitness FAQs and really practice what I preach. Shredded is people competing on a bodybuilding stage. We're talking sub 10% body fat. That is extreme dieting that is unsustainable. So we should get that idea of maintaining a shredded physique out of our vocabulary. With me, it's all the basic stuff. It's nutrition, it's eating whole foods, it's getting your protein intake, eating lean sources of protein, healthy fats, sufficient carbohydrates to meet my needs for whatever activity I'm doing. It's the other basics, sleeping 8 hours a day, non-negotiable. This feeds into maintaining this physique and also performance that I'm doing as well. Another healthy activity I do is step count, getting in that non-exercise physical activity for caloric expenditure and the whole host of other benefits that walking and steps achieve. 8,000 to 10,000 steps is what I average on day to help me eat enough food to fuel myself, but also have enough energy expenditure where I can maintain this type of physique. Drugs, alcohol, out of the picture. I don't drink, I don't smoke. This feeds into me living a lifestyle that I can recover, get that sleep in 8 hours a night, and it's a real lifestyle. It's a full commitment if you want to be looking this way. And it's my vocation, it's my profession, it's my passion, and it's a sacrifice that I'm willing to make at this stage. Further to this, your training. I've been training for 14 years. Hard, difficult, lots of volume, lots of intensity, focusing on performance progression, on the key compound movements, doing my isolation homework. This all helps to facilitate the aesthetic that I've managed to cultivate after all these years of training. What's also really helpful is tracking your weight. This keeps it objective, and you can see if things are trending the way you want it to. I track my weight daily, I take my weekly average. This allows me to remove myself from the day-to-day fluctuations in weight based on different foods, but it also allows me to track my trajectory if I'm looking for a caloric deficit to get leaner, if I'm looking for maintenance to stay where I'm at, or if I'm looking to go on a massing surplus phase. I can just track my weekly averages, tie that into where I'm going, and make the changes that I need. I personally eat intuitively. So as I said with the whole foods, I find that if I eat consistent portion sizes with the main foods that I eat, I can stay within the ballpark of my objectives without going OCD on tracking macros and all that stuff that is potentially required to get even more lean than this. So you need to decide what you can maintain, what you're willing to sacrifice for, and also just keeping it real with yourself by tracking and doing all of these habits and routines with your lifestyle to make it possible. William P asks, how to manage fatigue the best? How do I figure out if my workout schedule is too much or too less for my body? This is a great question and it can be very complicated, so I'll try and give you a nice summary and takeaway. Fatigue is multifactorial. You've got your resistance training stress that is a byproduct of you working out. You also have the other factors in your life, such as how much you're sleeping, what's the stress like with work, relationships, life in general. This is going to determine the fatigue that you're experiencing. The best thing that you can look at, I would say, is performance as a metric. You'll know if you're doing the sweet spot of work relative to rest and have a decent recoverable fatigue if your performance is trending upwards. Are you able to consistently add sets, reps, intensity in the way of more weight, harder progressions over the course of your training program? If you're able to do that from the start to the finish, of say a 6 to 8 week block of training, you are doing the right amount for your body and you're probably doing enough in order to progress and adapt because the numbers reflect that. You're getting stronger and you're likely building muscle in the process. I will say that the optimum fatigue management is always in flux because the stress from training and life, it's very complicated and it's hard to be completely consistent with all of this stuff. So you really need to know your signs and symptoms of overtraining or undertraining with a little bit of research and then marrying that up with the principles I just discussed for creating sustainable stress that you can recover from and improve. That is fatigue management in a nutshell. Pedro AG asks, what is the one question you want to be asked but no one does? Congrats on all the success. Thank you, and the question is, what is your favorite quote and why? My favorite quote is "The Man in the Arena" by the OG Teddy Roosevelt. For those of you that haven't heard it, I'll read it out. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who is at the best, knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. This is such a powerful quote. Why do I like this quote? It gives me the courage to overcome the fear of criticism in the face. Most people are so afraid of what others think, they live their lives being reactive instead of proactive. People regret what they don't do more than what they do. So I'd rather stand behind my values and ideas and contribute instead of being a critic. Regardless of what you do, people will judge you. So if you don't want criticism, say nothing, do nothing, and ultimately you'll be nothing. This is something that I've realized that's helped me have the courage to overcome this fear. DO404 asks, do you do weighted push-ups and weighted rows as part of your routine? Is it safe to load and unload heavy weights with them? Yes, I'm a strong believer in weighted rows and weighted push-ups, and I do them regularly in my routine. If you're someone who is able to do more than 30 push-ups and rows with your body weight, it's time to progress. You've graduated to weighted calisthenics. When we exceed 30 reps, we're building endurance and it's failing to be effective and efficient for building muscle, building strength. So much prefer to add load to these exercises. I prefer the 10 to 20 rep range for weighted calisthenics with push-ups and rows. The reason for this is because it is the safest way to load these movement patterns. By their very nature, you've got a lot of body posture that you need to control in these positions. So if we go to like 3 to 5 reps, one, we have to use really heavy weights, which is awkward to set up when you've got it around the chain hanging off you in push-ups, or if you're balancing plates on your stomach with bodyweight rows. It just gets a little bit tricky in that respect. By going too heavy, form breakdown is a real thing, and it's just not worth it to go so heavy. We have to look at why we're using push-ups and rows in the first place. These are more auxiliary or supplementary exercises that we put in the middle to later part of our workout. We usually start our workout with things like pull-ups and dips because they're harder exercises. So by adding weighted rows, weighted push-ups, and working them within the 10 to 20 rep range, we get the best of all worlds. We get the muscle building effect because we've got that moderate intensity. It is safe because we're not going to break down our posture really soon with heavy loads, and it's just not so awkward to set up. It's efficient, and I'd highly recommend getting on those if you're exceeding that 30 reps with body weight. Sean D asks, have you ever suffered from the pressure of seeing other people doing better skills than you, like when you compared yourself to others? And how did you deal with that pressure? This is normal, this is a human thing, we all experience that. Anyone that says they doesn't is potentially psychotic or they're being dishonest. I've felt this time and time again and I still do experience it to this day. And I feel that this is the curse of social media. We see people who are in the 1% of the population in terms of appearance, in terms of strength, in terms of flexibility. So when we're scrolling there, just trying to get motivated or maybe learn a thing or two, we'll come across that and be like, wow, that's really impressive. And you can go two ways with that. You can get salty that you're not as good, or you can draw inspiration from that in a healthy way. And I feel that understanding that what you see from others in the public space, especially on social media, is a distorted perspective of reality. And I know that most of you understand this, but you have to remind yourself, those that you're seeing doing these things, they are most likely 100% dedicated to doing that one thing. So unless you're willing to dedicate 100% to that one thing, comparing yourself to them is not a really healthy way to go about doing it. I honestly feel it's always bringing it back to the self. That is the classic antidote to comparison to others and feeling lesser as a result of looking at them. You can look at your own journey and you really do have to see that as the point in which you garner your gratification, self-fulfillment by what you've achieved from where you were, where you are currently, and where you'd like to be in the future. It's just a bit healthier to know with your genetics, your circumstances, your dedication, what you've achieved, because you don't know the other person's situation. You just see the highlight reel. Don't feel alone, because we all experience this, but just distancing yourself from this feeling and seeing it for what it is very healthy. Ayan Dodhi asks, how to maintain a dream physique? So if you're asking this question, you're someone who's been training for more than, say, 3 to 5 years. You've built muscle, you've built strength, you're pretty happy with the level that you've gotten to. You understand the sacrifice that's required to build. You're not willing to do that. Perhaps this is a part of your life where maintenance is something that you want to stick to. That's completely fine. I feel that maintenance isn't really a sexy topic, because you ask anyone how they're going, what are your goals? It's always, I want to improve, higher, always more, not satisfied. Something kind of cool about people that want to maintain for a little bit, it's a decision, and it's one that requires less effort than trying to improve, obviously. So the good news here is that you need less volume to maintain strength and muscle size compared to what's required to improve. So the simplest thing that you can do is reduce your volume. You don't have to do 4 sets of everything. You can reduce that to 2 or 3. As long as if you've got sufficient intensity in your workouts, it is going to put you in a position where maintenance is probable. You're not going to decline, but you're also not going to improve. I think that's commendable. I don't mind this idea of maintaining a dream physique. I think you should still mark your performance. So tracking your training, making sure that you are within similar intensities, you're using the same type progressions, you're using similar weights. With that said, you've still got to commit to the lifestyle. You still got to keep sleeping, you got to keep your nutrition on point, and you've still got to be training with sufficient difficulty and effort, because what was required to build it, you still need to keep those elements in order to maintain what you've got. The body doesn't want to hold on to muscle tissue. It's an expensive metabolic process, and you still have to fight for it through how you eat, your recovery, and sufficient stimulus to make sure your body wants to hang on to that. So you can't just completely disregard everything you've learned and all the habits that you've done with maintenance. It just requires a shift in your laser focus, 100% commitment. You can be a little bit more lax with what you're doing and get away with it. Mustafa YK asks the most popular question. How do you like to program weighted pull-up progression for intermediates, mainly looking forward to get stronger at pull-ups and put on overall size? Great question. I recommend training pull-ups twice per week. And on one of the days, you're focused on strength. One of the days, you're more biasing hypertrophy. On your strength day, 3 sets, 4 to 6 reps. On your hypertrophy day, you're doing 3 sets, 8 to 15 reps. I like this because I feel it gives you the best of both neurological strength gains and also a muscle building stimulus, which facilitates progress in your strength gains as well. It's also really fun because you're doing 2 different areas in 1 week. You're constantly feeling like you've got this variety, and it's not like you're just grinding at the same rep scheme over and over again. There's sufficient rest with a twice per week protocol where you can come back and improve on your previous effort, and you're not fatigued from doing really high frequency. You're not beating up your tendons, getting golfer's elbow, anything like that. Overuse injury is normal. For people asking this question, they'd just jump on 3-4 days of pull-ups a week. But we know often quality is better than quantity, less is more, and focusing on that allows you to have a sustainable approach. I really enjoy this way. There's many ways to go about improving for intermediates, but I feel that if you do both concurrently, it'll put you in a really good place. Mgor Chinsky asks, can you do a one-arm handstand? I used to train the one-arm handstand very seriously from 2018 to 2020. And after 2 years of dedication, I'm proud to say I was able to do a 10-second straddle one-arm handstand quite consistently on my right side, not so much on my left. And I was able to tick off this goal and be content with what I achieved with this exercise. When it comes to learning a one-arm handstand, it is not just twice as hard as a two-arm handstand. it is considerably harder. The reason for that is on two hands, you've got forward to back balance mainly. When you go to one hand, you take away that base of support, you got forward to back, you got side to side, and you've also got rotation. Then you've got up the chain to worry about. You've got the rotation at your hips, and it is a really, really challenging movement. So I think it's important everyone understands the complexity of that next goal from two to one. You need to respect it, and you know that it's going to take serious time and sacrifice to achieve. To give you an example, in that 2 year period, I was doing handstands 5 days a week for around 1.5 hours. And when it comes to skill work, you have to be consistent with it. You have to have a high frequency. There's a lot of neurological learning through skill work that has to happen. Tons of drills, tons of repetition. It's a lot of time required in the sessions to make sure that it is quality and also quantity. What everyone needs to understand too is that when you see someone with a crazy one-arm handstand, chances are they specialize in it and they dedicate themselves to it. I think it's important with this social media age that everyone has a realistic understanding of what you can achieve relative to what you see. And for me personally, I was really proud with what I got to with the one-arm handstand whilst also training calisthenics, while also doing flexibility, while also trying to build muscle size. And I feel that if I was to continue to try and progress in the one-arm handstand, there would have to be sacrifices to be made. And that's just not something that I'm willing to do. So for me, my main audience are generalists, you watching fitness FAQs. I know you want to build muscle. I know you want to get stronger. I know you want to build flexibility. And you also want to be able to have a base of handstands as well. You need to understand that in order to do everything, you have to sacrifice something. And that is often the extent of your progress. You might get to a one-arm handstand like me for 10 seconds. But you're not going to be able to do elite world-class hand balancing. Same thing if you're doing everything at once, you're not going to be the best looking in terms of muscularity. You're not going to be the strongest calisthenics athlete, but you're going to build little attributes of each. And the one-arm handstand really highlighted this for me personally. Basically, you can do anything you want within reason, but not everything to a really high level. I'm resigned to the fact that I'm going to be respectable at handstands, but I'm not going to be world-class. As long as if I have the ability to teach others and I'm happy with the level that I'm at, that's cool with me. That's it for the Q&A. Sorry if I didn't get a chance to answer your question, but if you made it this far, I appreciate you. You're a legend. You're the true MVP. Thank you for the support. And if you want to keep learning, check out the Fitness FAQs podcast for much more long-form content just like this. Peace.